Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Cindy DeFerdinand, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Cindy DeFerdinand.
Hi, everybody. Cindy. Welcome to our show.
Yes, welcome to another action-packed episode. I am so happy that we have a friend of mine here from the DFW area, a gentleman that I've just come to know and respect, and his work and getting to know him. I'm glad he's here to come on the show today to share with our listeners about his new book. And we have with us today Brian Cuban, who is an attorney, recovery advocate, and best-selling author. His first book, Shattered Image, was a wonderful book, and now he's on pre-order with his new book, The Addicted Lawyer. So, Brian, thank you for coming on.
Thanks so much for being here today,
Brian. Hey,
Bruce,
thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Welcome.
So, Brian, tell about your new book. What was some of the inspiration behind that, and what are some of the themes and messages you're trying to convey to your readership?
Well, the inspiration was my journey through recovery. I just had my 10th year in recovery, April 8th, from drugs and alcohol.
Congratulations.
I haven't done it. Thanks, which means I hadn't taken a drink or done cocaine since April 8th, 2007. So that's a nice milestone. Many more milestones to go, hopefully, you know, one day at a time. But in that journey, there were a lot of ups and downs. Two trips to a psychiatric facility, a suicide attempt, three failed marriages. One more, I get a free set of steak knives. and finally, lots of, you know, I failed career as a lawyer, lost my clients, doing cocaine in the bathroom, doing cocaine in the courtroom, doing cocaine in the office.
Yeah, you know,
all
be
the
a problem.
Stuff, which, people may or may not know my older brother, Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. I was trading Mavericks championship tickets for cocaine. So all the fun things that people suffering from addiction go do. You know, we all have stories, right?
Right. And the decisions, right? You know, it's interesting, like the book, you were saying it all started with addiction. And you also are an advocate for, you know, males suffering from eating disorders and body dysmorphia. And if you had to trace back just in your own life and look at the journey you traveled to get to where you are today, which is in a fabulous place, where would you say it all began?
Well, it certainly all began in childhood. But you got to remember, as you know, as clinicians, there's a difference between correlation and causation. I can't pin to any one environmental factor and say this is the cause of my eating disorder or this is the cause of the body dysmorphic disorder. But I can look back at a series of events. I had a difficult relationship with my mom. There was a lot of fat shaming in my family. That does not mean I blame my mother for what happened to me. Parents don't cause eating disorders and parents don't cause addiction.
Right. Good point, right?
This was just part of the... That's right. I mean, I certainly don't blame my mother or my parents for anything I went through. But environment is important, and there are many, many different environmental factors. There was fat shaming. I was bullied severely over my weight as a child. I was even physically assaulted.
Wow.
I had my pants ripped off me and thrown in the street because they looked funny on my big body. And I think a confluence of events combined with the fact that I was a very kind of middle child syndrome person. I was a middle child. Mark was the oldest, and then I have a younger brother, Jeff. Very shy, very needing of acceptance, very internalizing of negative things that were said about me. It just all came together to create the perfect storm.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. You talk about your position in the family. That's really well said. That sometimes the position in the family, and I love that you said that there were influences from family, from your family as a child. But certainly, you took responsibility, and there was no blame. But it was like a cumulative effect of all these different things that happened to you. And I was really, the bullying. I was really interested in how that affected you, and that experience that you have, which sounds really horrendous, affected you when you were, and how old were you at that point?
I was in my tweens, 14 to 15 year old and I was a heavy kid, and I was, it's funny. I used to eat a lot because it quelled my depression and made me feel better.
Right.
I was clinically depressed as a child, as a teenager. And as often happens, when you eat more, you get bigger and you change. And when you change, people, the bullying sometimes starts at school. And of course, this was in the 1970s when going viral meant 10 kids in the lunchroom knew about it, right?
Exactly.
So, but it doesn't hurt, but it's all contextual. It doesn't hurt any less.
Right.
So,
It's the impact of it. It definitely marked you, in a traumatic way, it sounds like.
That's right. And the kids would call me a fat pig, as my mother did. But these were my mother's mother called my mom a fat pig. My mother had a very verbally abusive relationship with her mother, and this stuff is often, passed down. And I would also be called these things by the kids at school when they would, as I gained weight. And I'll tell you, it all culminated one day and what I call the day of the gold pants. I remember it like it was yesterday. And this happened in Pittsburgh, PA, where I grew up. And it was so traumatic that I could go to this spot today and show you exactly where it happened.
Wow.
My older brother Mark was very into disco. This was in the mid 70s when disco was big.
I remember
John Travolta,
that.
Saturday Night Fever. Yeah.
Yep.
And Mark even taught disco at one time. And he had these gold, shiny satin disco pants, bell bottom.
Right.
And he used to wear them, and he looked, back then they looked good on him. But Mark wasn't a big guy, so these pants were tight on me, and Mark gave me the pants. He came into my room one day and said, "Here, you want these?" I said, "Sure, I love my brother." And to me, it was validation of my brother's love. He'd give me these pants.
Yeah, that was nice.
And I decided I was going to wear these pants to school. But these pants were really tight. So my butt looked like 15 cats back there. You have to jump up and down and spray the water bottle to get them on. And I wore the pants to school, and the kids made fun of me. And one day I'm walking home from school with these kids, and they all decided that I would look much better if these pants were ripped off me. And so they physically assaulted me. They tore my shiny gold disco pants into shreds and threw them out in the street a mile from home, down to my Fruit of the Loom tighty whities.
Right. Mm. Unbelievable. I think bullying is such, it's such an important thing, the anti-bullying, campaigns that go on. And one of the coaching classes I did, I had a couple, and they were going to support that cause. And I'm really glad that you go out and speak about this. Because, like you said, how deeply it impacted you, and depending on the event, it may not impact everybody the same way, but it had a really dramatic effect on you. And so that's really, Brian, how you sort of see it's sort of really beginning, that turning point.
You can look at a confluence of events. You can't really point to a bright line, but I remember that being around the time, that incident, and the walk of shame home, a mile home in my Fruit of the Looms.
Wow.
Trying to cover up my privates. When I remember sort of seeing myself in a different way in my reflection. And so I look back and I think those are the very early underpinnings of body dysmorphic disorder.
Right. And maybe you could tell our audience, I'm a clinical nutritionist and coach, and I'm also from Butler, Pennsylvania. So I know that.
Okay, sure.
Interestingly enough. And some of our audience may not understand what that means, but that word that you start looking in the mirror and you see yourself different. You could explain that so that they kind of get the progression of that and what it meant to
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. But body dysmorphic disorder is when you take a small or non-existent perceived defect in your body and exaggerate it to the point in your perceived reflection that it affects your ability to function, quote, normally, unquote, in life. Mm-hmm. Some people may abuse plastic surgery. There's a 30% correlation with eating disorders, drug addiction, alcohol, suicide. It affects about 2 to 3% of the population, men and women equally.
Yeah,
for me, it was my stomach.
It was your – I'm sorry, Brian, I missed that.
For the perceived defect for me was my stomach.
Stomach, okay. And you know, sometimes we call that distorted body image. Do you see it as –
Yes.
Okay. Just so some of our audience may understand that better. So,
yes, it's distorted body image, yes.
Right, okay. And – so it started there for you, and then and your stomach was the main issue. And then what happened from there? I mean, so you're 14, 15 when this major tragic event happens to you.
I eventually went on to high school. Went on to college. And in college, my freshman year in college, there was an event that may seem trivial to some people, but it was a very memorable event to me because I was somebody who was already broken and already had a negative self-image.
Right.
I was with my father at Penn State University my freshman year, and it was freshman orientation. I'm in my dorm room. My father's helping me unpack, and I had never been on a date. I'd never kissed a girl. I'd never held a girl's hand. I felt I was too unloved and too ugly to ever ever experience that. So I just isolated. So I make eye contact with this girl who was unloading with her family, talking to her friends, this pretty long brown-haired, curly-haired girl. And I think she's smiling at me. And I start sweating. I literally start sweating, I remember. And my heart starts palpitating, you know, like I just done some cocaine. And I remember thinking, like, in the space of 15 seconds, okay, this is my new girlfriend. I'm going to marry this girl. We're going to have 2 and 1/2 children. My life is set.
Right.
The hope began that I would finally even get to hold a girl's hand. Oh. You know, I wanted to be that kid who went to the prom and who went on the dates and went to the after school parties. But I was never that kid because I was too ashamed of myself. Mm. I hated what I saw in the mirror. So I just projected out that I would always be rejected, and that was an easier way to live.
Right.
So
you just avoided everything, right?
I just avoided everything.
Right.
I isolated.
Mm-hmm.
So this girl, it wasn't a smile. It was a smirk. She looks at me, turns to her two friends, turns back to me, cups her hands over her mouth, and goes, ugly, ugly. Now, I am not the first teenager to have nasty things said to him, right? It happens all the time on the internet. It's an epidemic.
Yeah, unfortunately,
That's right. And people may deal with that different ways. Some teenagers may have yelled back ugly right back at her. Some would have sloughed it off, you know. But I was somebody who was already broken. I was somebody who already had a negative self-image. So to me, it was just one more thing. You know, she must have talked to the kids at school. She must have talked to my mom. That kind of thought process.
Right. Just another nail in the coffin, right?
That's right. And it was then that I remember thinking that my entire life was out of control. And I had to do something to get control. And what did I have control over? Food. The only thing I had control over was food in my mind. I didn't want to eat more because I associated that with bullying. I decided that if I would begin to lose weight, I would be accepted. I would be loved. I would finally go on a date. This was before the age of the internet. In my mind, the popular kids were the kids I saw every day. There were no digital images, right? It was the prom king, the prom queen, the kids going to McDonald's, the beer parties. And in my mind, they were all good looking, pretty, thin. If I could be that, I would finally be loved by my mother. I would finally get to kiss a girl. I would finally have friends.
The eating disorder began right about that age?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That is when I began to restrict. And I started to lose weight, and I began to restrict more and more and more. And as a freshman at Penn State University in 1979, before eating disorders were talked about publicly for either men or women, I had discovered anorexia. I had begun anorexic behavior. And of course, I had no idea what eating disorders were. Karen Carpenter had not passed away yet, the singer, bringing right. anorexia into the pre-digital national spotlight. But for
yeah,
women,
yeah, that was the
men.
Big moment when it came out, right?
That's right. So you can't even say there was a stigma back then, because for there to be a stigma, there has to be a public conversation, and there
right.
was none.
It really wasn't understood or discussed, yeah.
That's right. So it was just something that I inherently knew was shameful. But what I also knew was the more weight I lost, the more I felt like the next day I will wake up and the sun will shine. Everything will be great. For each pound told me that everything would be great.
Life got better with each pound. And, you know, it's important to and I'm sure you know this too, Brian, that there's varying degrees of this as well, you know, in terms of weight loss, people focused on their body. I mean, there's the extreme. And
that's
then
right.
Right.
It's important to point out that weight, body weight, is only one aspect of an eating disorder. Okay. So I did not, I kept restricting and restricting, thinking the next day, more weight, everything's going to be great. I'd be accepted. But I did not fit this stereotype. Okay. We see, you know, the ribs and all that. And it's unfortunate when we think of eating disorders in that way, because weight is only one aspect of an eating disorder. Weight does not define an eating disorder. I looked, if you would have looked at me back then, I looked like anyone else.
Like normal.
And
yeah.
I looked normal because I was mm-hmm. going from very heavy to a weight that was really quote unquote normal.
Right.
And I hate to use the word normal with weight, because we are enough no matter how we look, right?
How much we weigh. Absolutely.
We have this saying in eating disorder recovery, you are enough. No matter what your weight is, no matter what your body type, you are loved. Love yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a concept foreign to me back then. And so to me, love began to equate with losing weight. And at the end of that year, moving into my sophomore year, I transitioned to bulimia, traditional bulimia, which is binging and purging.
Right.
Every time I binged and purged, just like the losing of weight, every time I binged and purged, for the few moments, I felt like everything was going to be okay. But when that high, and it literally was a high after the binging and purging, went away, what happened was this shame just swept in, filling the void. Shame of just inherently
yeah.
feeling I had done something boys don't do. Men don't do. It is a shameful act. But not knowing it's called bulimia. Bulimia had only been a word in the clinical diagnosis since 1976. And here, this is 1979,
crazy, huh?
1980. Yeah, so yes. I didn't know what it was. And so what happens? I had to have that feeling again and again and again. The life of a bulimic, mm-hmm. the life of a female bulimic, the life of a male bulimic. And I did not go into recovery for my bulimia until 2007. I dealt with it for over two decades on and off.
Wow,
so
that's a long 40s, time.
That is a long
time. Yeah, that's
time.
A long time. That's a lot of stress for a very long time. To be dealing with that. When did the, and I, you know, I love that you're an advocate for this, because I absolutely agree that everybody really sees this as a female disorder. You know what I mean?
That's right.
And so the fact that there are, I don't know the exact percentages, but of men that actually, oh, you do? Okay, great. Maybe you
yes,
could share that with us.
The most recent Harvard study shows about 20 to 25% of all those suffering from eating disorders are male, but only 1 in 10 will get treatment.
Wow.
And,
wow.
And that is up from the
That's a lot. That's a lot.
10%. Yes. Yes. And that is up from the textbook 10% that's in all the textbooks that we are trying, you know, that many people are trying to get changed to update the research. And now, of course, we have the fastest growing eating disorder that affects predominantly men is binge eating disorder. A very shameful thing. And so, and that affects predominant and that affects disproportionately men.
Right. And so the binge comes without the purge. And then, of course,
without
weight gain
the purge, that's right.
Weight gain comes with that. I always think about bulimia as sort of the break-even disorder in terms of weight, because typically you're binging, purging. You may look normal in terms of weight, not like an anorexic, but if weight, you know, is your weight loss is a goal, it's hard to achieve it that way. You know, it's really.
Well, that goes back to my prior comment. Wait, why mm-hmm. We shouldn't use weight to define anything.
Right, right.
But you're right. Bulimics are generally at or above weight.
Exactly. So
people with binge eating disorder are generally above weight.
Yeah, yeah. It's really harder to, you don't see it. You know, in anorexia, you actually can see it. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, even with like anorexia, it's you know, pretty high percentage of people die from having this disorder. I mean, it's really, really serious. And so
disorders have the highest mortality rate of any psychological illness.
Yeah, it's huge. And so it's very much a life-threatening disorder I'm sorry, Bruce, you may jump in at any time. I had to take over, right, in terms of the questioning. It's so interesting to me. From the bulimia, the eating disorder, and then the anorexia to the bulimia, you know, did that then lead into your addiction issues?
Well, I transitioned it to exercise bulimia.
Oh,
which
okay.
Obsessive compulsive exercise with the primary goal of offsetting calories.
Yep, yep. And so
I began running 10 miles a day, 20 miles a day, marathons, races. And this was in addition to being traditionally bulimic. So I was binging and purging and running 10 to 20 miles a day.
Wow.
And for me, it was perfect because I was somebody who felt like he was never going to be loved. So why not be alone? Do things I can do alone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So was that, did that become more isolating to you?
Yes. And, but for me, it was the life I knew was to isolate. Here's an example. I went to Penn State University. Football is very big.
Yep.
And so the stadiums I went to a couple football games. I was never a huge football fan. In a stadium, I would walk into a stadium of 100,000 people on a Saturday afternoon and feel like every person in that stadium. And this is not unusual for somebody with body dysmorphic disorder. I felt like every person in that stadium was looking at me and saying, he is an ugly fat pig. Why is he here?
Wow.
So what became easier was to go for long runs while the games were going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I could be alone and not have to look at all the students going to the games, on dates, holding hands, having fun. And thinking I would never be part of that. So I would just go on these long 10-mile runs, 15-mile runs, 20-mile runs. And I would be binging and purging as well. A lot of stress on the body.
Yeah, very much. Very, very much stress on the body. How long? So you're saying like over a period of 20 years, the eating disorder, the bulimia, the exercise, that all you just kind of rolled it together? You continued all that? Okay. All right.
Yes. Yes. And then I became old enough to drink, and I discovered alcohol. You know, back then it was 21. What is it 21 now? I don't even know.
Depends on the state.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, it was 21 years old back then. So I began to drink heavily, and I became an alcoholic at 21 years old. It was what I call a behavior wheel. I was instinctively cycling through all these destructive behaviors, instinctively trying to fix myself in a destructive way. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was trying to find this, the one thing that would allow me to love myself and going through all these destructive behaviors. So it wasn't a conscious choice. It was going from the one thing to the next that I could do that was user friendly to change how I felt about myself.
Right. And maybe
often the case of addiction.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And also, you know, that feeling in control, you know, like I can handle something, I can manage something.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And
so I became an alcoholic at Penn State.
And what about the cocaine? Because I know you became a cocaine addict as well.
Yeah.
And I guess that would play well into what Bruce's question was about, you know, your book, the new book, The Addicted.
Sure. Kind of just moving my history.
Yeah, it's
to make it to Penn State, I was an alcoholic, And it's kind of funny. I remember the closest I ever came to maybe some self-awareness as a young man back then was I walking drunk, of course, into a hamburger joint where the 12-step organizations, you know, this was all there was back then, put out pamphlets, the rack of pamphlets of 20 questions, if you're familiar with that. So you open up the pamphlet, it says, or, you know, do you black out? Do you do this? And I'm checking off yes to all these things in my mind. And I'm like, ah, I'm just a college student. Everyone drinks. And that was about it.
So you're saying to yourself, everybody checks yes on all these.
Yeah, I'm like, this is just normal.
That's like kind of a normal behavior for a lot of college students. I get that.
It's kind of funny. I do a lot of speaking at colleges, and some smart aleck kid will always raise her hand and say, well, you're not an alcoholic till you graduate. And I'm like, let me tell you something. I was an alcoholic. That's not true. I was a binge drinking alcoholic. I was a bulimic alcoholic. So it was, that is not true. But I did manage to graduate from Penn State, and I did okay. I had a kind of a gift. I could pull a sober all nighter and give back the information the next day on a test and do pretty good. So
did that bring you self-esteem? Was there any balance there? I'm just curious. It's like if you performed academically, did that bring any?
No, because none at all, because I had no vision of my future. It was survival. Every day was just survival. I have to survive. Okay. I'll go run. I have to drink. I'll survive. I have to pass this test to survive. I had no vision of the future. And because I had no vision of the future, and here we're leading into the law, I did not want to go out in the real world when I graduated Penn State, because to go out in the real world, I knew instinctively that I was going to have to let people see the ugliness inside me. And I didn't want that to happen. Survival was isolating, and people would see how ugly I really was, and how, you know, the ugliness I saw in myself. So it made perfect sense to me just to go on and continuing my studies, and that's why I decided to go to law school.
Okay, that makes sense.
I went to the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. I did not go to be Clarence Darrow. I did not go to make a lot of money. I did not go to change the world. I went to law school so I could hide for 3 more years and not have to deal with showing anyone my eating disorder, my heavy drinking, and I could continue to run 10 to 20 miles a day. I could repeat the exact same things at Penn State and survive. That's why I went to law school.
It was just to extend what you were currently doing. You were just kind of trying to extend I'm with you. You know, you said something interesting, and Bruce, maybe you picked this up when, as coaches, when you were saying you had no vision of your future at that point in 1976. It's a big field in coaching. Yes. You know, coaching is unlike therapy, where you go back into your past and deal with some of the disorders that you're talking about, which need to be diagnosed. Coaching is really taking somebody from where they're at right here, right now, and helping them find what they really, really want and move forward. So it's really forward focused. And
an excellent point.
A lot of coaching, and there are a lot of coaches that are focused on that age group, you know, and I know, Bruce, you do some work. I do some work with folks in their 20s, you know, and I know Bruce does some work with what he calls, you know, the failure to launch. But that's really interesting that you brought that up, because besides not having a vision of your future, which now with all the coaching out there, young people can get the support that they need, and it's very rewarding to coach young people. You also had, on top of that, all of these different disorders and issues on top of it. So I can certainly understand why you were making the decision to just stay put and keep doing what you were doing.
Absolutely. And I had no tools back then. This was 1983. I had no tools. So the easiest thing to do was just stay in school, because I could use the tools I had were destructive tools, but they were the only tools I knew.
Right, right. So it's all you knew. So you kept doing what you knew, and really stay in isolation, right?
That's right. And you brought up an excellent point that we can move to later as I move to recovery. One of the biggest issues I see today, I work with a lot of lawyers, I work with a lot of law students, people who just email me about recovery. It is one thing. I tell people, if I have to compare getting sober and dealing with where I was and moving into long-term sobriety was exponentially easier than figuring out how I got there. Nobody wants to look back and figure out how they got there, right? Because that means tearing back all the layers of your life.
Right.
To little children, to teenagers mm-hmm. who may have been abused sexually,
right,
physically,
right, right.
had terrible relationships. It's easier just to say, no, I'm getting sober. I'm in 12-step. I'm doing this. And 12-step is great. Don't get me wrong. But dealing with where you are is not the same as dealing with how you got there.
Right.
And until you deal with how you got there, you are always going to be subject to relapse. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think that what you're talking about, why you know, how you got there, why you got there, and what kind of disorders or trauma contributed to it, it definitely has that therapeutic ring, like getting into therapy and figuring it out. Because it is tough to do all that work on your own. And I agree that some people would like to just, you know, shut the door and move forward. They really don't want to look back. And if you don't do that, you're not really being authentic, because those things are really imprint and make you who you are today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if I didn't, and again, we're getting ahead of ourselves now, but if I didn't work on repairing the relationship with my mother, and we have a great relationship now, she comes to listen to me speak when I'm, you know, when it's close, that would, the anger, the boiling, festering anger at my mom when it wasn't her fault, and the bullies, any, you know, that can always move to a point of, you know, of triggering me into relapse. So I had to work on those things.
Or at best, making you miserable.
or making me a miserable, sober person. That's
fun to be around,
right.
just angry, right?
Yeah, so, but in the end, everything comes to a boiling point, and how are you going to release that? So so it's always better to work on it.
Right, better to go through it, right.
That's right. That's right. And I work on it today. I'm still in therapy over a decade. I think everyone should be in therapy.
I personally believe everybody needs a therapist. A family needs one. Individuals need one. Children, couples. And I'm, you know, obviously, you know, Bruce and I are both coaches, and I love the field of coaching and what it does and how quickly it moves people forward. It's one
absolutely.
Of the most rewarding things I've ever done professionally. And people
need
that
support. I've been sober a decade now. No, you're right. No, it's valuable. I've been sober a decade now, and I've been in therapy over a decade. One does not necessarily, you know, coexist with the other. We have to work on everything daily.
That's right. That's right. And the fact that you have done the work and you stay in therapy and you've worked through it instead of just denying it.
Well, he's still doing the work, too, it sounds like.
Right,
well.
Right.
Every
yeah.
day. Every
yeah.
day. Yeah, I do the work every day. I try to recover a little bit more and feel a little bit more better about myself every day. I still have struggles, and I still have a very difficult relationship with exercise and food. Because of the exercise bulimia, my mind will look at a bagel and automatically convert it to calories and say, okay, I have to work out this long. I constantly have to deal with that, and I'm constantly in therapy dealing with that because that is still there with me.
Yeah, I know. I work with people in my practice, and it's all about the numbers to them instead of the enjoyment of food and the nutrition you can get from food. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, and it's a long journey to healthier thinking about food. So I commend you for staying on that journey and continue to work on it. From where we sit right here, right now, as I'm listening to you, you sound amazingly confident. I mean, just the courage it must have taken to walk through all that, but just not walk through it, but write about it, speak about it, just really put yourself out there is to me such a courageous thing. So that's tribute to all the work that you've done and continue to do. And the help you're giving everybody else is
from
benefiting.
From an eating disorder. From an eating disorder standpoint, I get emails from men all the time who repeat the same thing that I felt for so many years. They'll say I thought I was the only one.
Wow.
You know, a male with bulimia. I thought I was the only one. A male with binge eating disorder. I thought I was the only one. And that is how I felt. That is how I felt. And there was, you know, and I was going through this while the internet was around too. I could have looked and found out I wasn't the only one, but you know why I didn't? Because I was afraid I would find out I was the only one. That is how overpowering that is.
I thought you were going to say because you didn't want to stop. But even more important to you was that you really believed that you were that different from everybody else, right?
I did. I was totally ashamed, and I felt totally isolated, which is a very common issue with anyone with eating disorders, but for men particularly because it is such a stigmatized issue.
Right.
But jumping backwards, that's right. Jumping backwards from Penn State, so I went on to Pitt Law. And because of my drinking and because I was a terrible student, you can't just study the night before in law school and get a good grade. It doesn't work that way, but I tried. So, and I was not a good law student. I drank, I ran. All those things were more important to me than going to class. And I graduated by the skin of my teeth. I went through with mental health issues. I knew nothing about residential treatment. I knew nothing about counseling. This was in the mid-80s when it still wasn't a really big thing. In the mid-80s, really, you were still either in, you were either in 12-step, in a hospital, or not in treatment, right?
Right, right.
Although we were starting to move into an era of where residential treatment became a little more known. But back then, that's all there was.
Yeah, and I mean, we've come so far, but there's still stigma. I mean, I think we've come so far. But I really think you're helping to support that. So once you got out of law school, what happened?
Well, I barely graduated law school, and I graduated as a functioning alcoholic and bulimic. I moved to Dallas, Texas. And I moved to Dallas, Texas, this is 1986, because I wanted to be with my two brothers, Mark and Jeff, who had already moved here, which is where I am now. I felt I wanted one. I still had a terrible relationship with my mom at that point. I felt like there was no future for me in Pittsburgh. Black people were beating down my door to offer me jobs. Not that I even wanted to work. I just wanted to survive. I decided I would move to Dallas. I would move in with my brother, Mark. My brothers and I are very close. He had moved here several years before. And I felt like if I was with my brothers, everything would be okay. Their love would save me, as if love can, right. If love can solve addiction, right? Mm. If it was that simple.
Cannot, right?
It was more like throwing gasoline on a fire because they didn't know anything about my issues. They're young. This is the mid-80s. They're dating. There's girls. They're going to parties. I fit right in. And then in 1987, in a bathroom in a hotel in Dallas, Texas, I discovered cocaine. I did my first line of cocaine, and for the first time in my life, for those moments of the high, I looked in the mirror and I saw something I loved. And I saw something I felt people loved. And I saw someone who would be popular and finally go on dates. I've only kissed one girl in my life, and here now I'm in my mid-20s. That is how much, and not that there's anything intrinsically wrong with that, but it was because I was so disgusted with myself that I didn't think anyone would love me. Does that make sense?
Right. No, it makes perfect sense.
I avoided it. I avoided it because I projected out every girl had talked to that brown-haired girl at Penn State and thought I was ugly.
Right.
Or talked to my mom and thought I was a fat pig. Or had talked to the bullies that had ripped my pants off and were laughing at me. That's how my mind worked back then.
Mm.
So I did the line of cocaine, and that all changed. In those moments, looking in that mirror after I walked out of that stall where I did the line.
Was it more impactful than the drinking, it sounds like, to you?
Oh my goodness. I became an addict right then.
Okay.
I became a cocaine addict instantly. Not from a physical dependent standpoint, because we know there's a difference, right?
Right.
You can get physically dependent on opiates and stuff. It was a psychological dependence at that point.
It was going to be your thing.
I became psychologically addicted to that feeling, to being that person that the high created in that bathroom. And in that moment, I became a cocaine addict. And anyone that says you can't become an addict the first time needs to talk to me, because I did. I had to have that feeling and see that suave, good-looking, loved guy in the mirror again and again and again. And cocaine and alcohol began to consume my life. They consumed my life through three failed marriages, all of them failing because I spent all my energy hiding my issues from my significant others, wearing the masks You know, we wear an addiction to have to look respectable for the moments in time we need to look respectable, right? To hide it from the public, hide it from our family, hide it from our wives, hide it from our girlfriends. And when you spend all that energy, so your significant other doesn't see what's going on, there's no room for love. There's no room to allow yourself to be loved. There's no room to love anyone else.
Well, because it's time consuming, right? It's a lot of work.
It's exhausting. It's absolutely exhausting. And what eventually happens in that type of relationship, it will devolve to you don't love me from your significant other. And what becomes the path of least resistance? Because you don't want to, because to say yes, I do means you have to open up and be vulnerable, right? It becomes easier to say, you're right, I don't. Path of least resistance, dirty secret saved, divorce. Three marriages like that.
Wow.
And so I would, my cocaine addiction took me through my time as a lawyer. I lost all my clients. I would do cocaine in the bathrooms. I was of counsel to the law firms. I would be doing cocaine in the bathrooms. I would go into court high. I'd never had my license suspended and I still have my law license, but I'll tell you what, it wasn't for a lack of trying.
Right. Right. Or that you didn't deserve to have it taken away. You work with attorneys, right? Today?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I do. And that's many nice. Have gone through the same things that I went through, and many have been disbarred and suspended. The one thing I never did was take money from a client, and a lot of times with lawyers, what happens is you get so deep into your addiction, and it's not just lawyers, right? We lie, cheat, and steal to fund our habit, right?
Right.
That goes through that cuts across all professions when you get deep into addiction. And I was kind of privileged because I was very fortunate. I had a very wealthy brother who was made sure I never lived under a bridge. And I think if it got to the point where I was destitute, I would have stolen from clients. So I don't say that as a badge of honor. I say that because I kind of lived a first world privilege, and I acknowledge
right.
that. Because I did have a brother. Mm-hmm. I had protection. I had a brother mm-hmm. who I won't say, I don't like to call it enabling, because when you go back and say, and I get this question all the time, well, do you think he enabled you? How would your life be different if he hadn't? Well, that's revisionist recovery, right?
Mm-hmm.
If he hadn't, I might have succeeded in taking my own life. I might have been living under a bridge, but instead I'm here talking to you.
Right. So, Sometimes it's loving someone. You know what I mean? It's not always enabling.
Right. So was there a degree of enabling? Of course, yes. But it kept me to a point where I was able to find recovery. So I went on. I lived like that. That is how I lived. And my brother Mark, when he bought the Dallas Mavericks, he knew I had no clients and I was struggling. He allowed me to come work for him, and he gave me a chance to succeed. He really did. He put me in charge, his point person, in charge of the construction of our American Airlines Center, which he had bought as well. And I failed. I failed miserably. I would show up for the meetings, construction meetings, hungover. I would do cocaine going into construction meetings. And I think Mark finally said, okay, I'm just going to support him and put him in a position where he's not going to be under a bridge. And he did. And I love my brother, and I thank him for that, because I finally did find recovery. And I don't know where I would have been if he hadn't done that. In 2005, I became very close to taking my own life. My brothers came in my room, and I had a .45 automatic on my nightstand. There was cocaine everywhere. There was black market Valium everywhere. And I had decided to end my life. And fortunately, a friend of mine who I emailed for bullets to the gun got a hold of my brothers and said, you have a problem.
Yeah, thank goodness, huh?
You need to go check on your brother. And in the summer of 2005, they came into my house and they took the weapon, and they took me my first trips down to Green Oaks Psychiatric Hospital. Now it's just called Green Oaks Hospital. And they took me down there kicking and screaming because I wasn't ready for recovery. I remember them taking me down, and my only thought was, why are you interfering in my life? right? You know, leave me alone.
Why are you stopping
that
on my fun?
That was my sole thought. why are you interfering in my life? And, of course, they love me, and they're trying to save my life, but that certainly wasn't my state of mind. I wasn't ready. And so they took me to Green Oaks, and I was in there with the psychiatric physician and the psychiatric attending nurse, and I'm a lawyer, and I knew what to say. Not a danger to myself, not a danger to others. They couldn't hold me. So we did what I call the Cuban rehab. My brothers took me back home, and they don't know what to do. We're like any other family. They weren't sure what to do. I was privileged. Mark offered to self-fund. Mark offered to pay for cash for residential treatment. And I said, no, I'm not doing it. Get out of my life, right? Telling my brothers who love me, get out of my life. And so they take me back home. They took my car key and said, stay here for 2 weeks. You'll be fine and sober up. My first thought was, that's fine. My cocaine dealer delivers.
Oh, jeez.
So go ahead.
Talk to you later. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was my thought process when they took me back home. And so I hung around the house for 2 weeks, and certainly and my cocaine dealer did deliver. And I was right back out drinking and doing drugs and, you know, with the eating disorder. And at this point, my brothers, of course, know I have a drug problem. They know I have a drinking problem, and they clearly know I have a clinical depression problem. But what are they going to do? I wasn't ready to recover. And what do we know? I mean, unless the person's ready, all the love in the world isn't going to save you, right?
Yeah. Can't get them sober.
I wasn't ready. I didn't want it. And so different relationships, just out, distancing myself from my family now, because now they know. And so to me, the logical thing is to distance from my brothers, my father, and now my mom lived in Pittsburgh in the house we grew up in. And
right. So more isolating.
And now I have no client. I think I had one legal client, and Mark was basically supporting me. And so I met another girl in 2006. Her name was Amanda. And we started dating. And of course, I went through the whole put on the mask, you know, do the things I need to do, you know, do my drugs and drink when we're not together. And of course, in my mind, well, I can quit this anytime, right? If it turns out that she's the one, I'll just stop, as if that can work.
If she turns out she's the one. I love that.
Yeah. And I'll just stop. I can quit this anytime. And I remember telling my friends that I can stop this blow anytime. Like that's worked before. I went through a million of those, day after relapses, you know, I'll never do this again. And then, of course, as the memory of the crappy night fades, of course, it's just a blip and you're right back at it. And there was a DWI, you know, jail. None of that was enough to get me into recovery. But I met this girl, and I remember we started dating. I'd doing pretty well hiding all this from her. And it was April 2007, Easter weekend. She went away for the weekend. She had moved in with me. And the next thing I know, it's Sunday, and she had left like Thursday or Friday, and it was Sunday, and she's staring down at me in bed in the house we lived in. There's drugs everywhere. There's alcohol bottles everywhere. And there was a condom on the floor. I'd clearly been unfaithful. I had no idea where the 2 days had gone. I had had a blackout. I'd had a drug and alcohol and Valium-induced blackout.
Was that your moment? Was that your moment? The turning point moment? Like that whole experience?
There. Yeah. So she drove me down to the same psychiatric facility, my second trip. And I'm thinking, you know, she's crying and I'm thinking she's gone. And she actually stood by me. She stood by me and we got married a few months ago.
That's nice. Congratulations.
And I had to thanks. And I had to, it took a long time to rebuild that trust.
Bruce, did you say something?
We're about 1 minute. We got to wrap it. Yeah, unfortunately.
This is such an incredible story. I think we need part two.
Yeah,
Brian.
We might need part two. I'll tell you that was the turning point. Standing in the parking lot of that psychiatric facility the second time was the turning point. The next day, I walked into my psychiatrist's office and started getting honest with him about what was going on. The day I walked into 12-step and I took my desire chip. And since then, that was April 8th, 2007, I had not I have not done drugs. I have not done drugs. I have not had a drink, and I've not binged and purged either.
Nice.
And there has
nice.
Been a lot of other types of therapy. It hasn't just been 12-step.
We definitely have to do part two if you have time, because this you are just an amazing speaker, like it, you know, a guest, just like I'm on pins and needles waiting for the next.
I didn't mean a monopolized show.
No, it was fabulous. I mean, really, so thank you so much for coming on and for telling your story. Maybe give us some contact information where people can reach out. Bruce, what do you think?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Brian. Go ahead.
Yeah, anyone can email me at brian@addictedlawyer.com. I am an open book. Anyone can email me. Feel free to reach out to me anytime. I have my website, www.briancuban.com, where I do a lot of blogging there. And nice. I also blog on a website called Above the Law, so you can find me there. Mm-hmm. But, yes, if you want to have me back on, we can talk about the recovery part.
Fabulous. And also the books and the success and building your life
the book,
and how fabulous it is.
My new book, The Addicted Lawyer, Tales of the Bars, Booze, Blow, and Redemption, is already an Amazon bestseller, and it's only in pre-order. So you can go there if you want to check it out.
Fabulous.
And so everything's good, and I'd love to come back on and talk about my recovery, because it wasn't just 12-step, and it was difficult.
Yeah, and if you're available next week, we can even maybe do it next week. But I'll give you
I'll give you a shout.
You a holler, a PM, Brian. So thanks for coming.
Thank
today,
you so much
folks.
For being with us. Thank you so much.
And folks, we're gonna go.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to talk nonstop. I hope it was.
No, it was wonderful.
We'll get it on part two. So, folks, with that, thanks for listening to the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. Our shows are archived at latalkradio.com on our page. Also, here in a few days, this episode and all of our shows are on iTunes and Google Play. So check us out there. We also got picked up by Podcast Addict earlier this week. So yay. And so again, thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you here next week on the
Have a great rest of the day.
On LA Talk
Take care.
Radio. Have a good week.
Bye-bye.